I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera. Fifth Movement, Taken by Storm, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that is, as always, me. Anne Cross, Jeff DePew, Philip Jeremy Moyer, and Matt Wagner. Comet Task Force Continues to Challenge Triads, by City Desk correspondent Emily Wong. Republic City, Liu Yue 11th. The Republic City Police Department's ongoing battle against the encroachment of the dangerous street drug known as Comet took another step forward early this morning, as the multilateral task force charged with stopping the drug's spread conducted a daring raid against a Comet trafficking operation in the waterfront district. Acting on information gathered in several undercover operations, members of the unit popularly known as the Comet Task Force raided the Xianyan Zhangfang Tea Room just after midnight, arresting several men and women who were allegedly engaged in receiving the illegal substance in bulk and repackaging it for distribution. Supported by officers of the RCPD's Special Tactical Division, Comet Task Force members led by Detective Inspector Eitaro Imanishi engaged and subdued several firebenders, two of whom were allegedly under the active influence of Comet. After the patrons and staff were removed from the premises, the task force seized more than 50 gin of drugs, proceeds from illicit drug sales, and related paraphernalia. The RCPD's Organized Crime Control Division has long associated the Xianyan Zhangfang Tea Room with one of the city's most powerful and violent crime syndicates, the notorious Agni Kai Firebending Triad, and most of those arrested in this morning's raid are known associates of that organization, said Inspector Imanishi after the raid. It appears that the Agni Kai's recent difficulties haven't affected their operations as much as we might have hoped. The alleged headquarters of the Agni Kai Triad, an office building in northern Firetown, burned to the ground last week in what a Republic City Fire Department spokesperson described as highly suspicious circumstances. No suspects have yet been named, nor criminal charges filed in that incident, which is not believed to be directly connected with the Comet Task Force's activities. When asked for comment on the task force's future plans, Inspector Imanishi refused to discuss specifics, citing the need to protect the officers involved in the ongoing operation. He restated the unit's intention to drive Comet out of Republic City and make sure that any organizations found dealing in these drugs will suffer the fullest consequences prescribed under the law. The people of Republic City refuse to bow to the whims of organized crime, he said. It is our responsibility to bring this illegal and dangerous trade to an end, and we will do so. Cora had lately adjusted her long-standing morning routine to include a stop on the city page of the Tribune before proceeding to the sports scores. After reading Emily's report on the latest raid, she rummaged in her pants pocket, pulled out her gear phone, and thumbed a speed dial key. Imanishi, the inspector's familiar voice answered on the second ring. Hey, Eitaro, I was checking out this morning's Tribune. Seems like Emily's really fitting in well with you guys. Imanishi chuckled over the line and had a clear grin in his voice as he responded, What Ms. Wong didn't mention in her copy is that she helped out with that engaging and subduing bit. One of the ones who had gotten hopped up on Comet tried to torch us, so she threw up a firebreak using the shop's floor, then Earth bent his feet out from under him. Ha! Said Cora triumphantly. I knew she was wasted on the society page. You're not kidding, Imanishi replied. I have to admit I was a little nervous about bringing her along at first, but she's been a great help. She kept a lot of people from getting hurt last night. If she wasn't so dead set on being a reporter, I'd probably try to get her a badge. Well, you can't win them all. So true. Now it was Cora's turn to laugh. Oh, hey, before I forget, We're having a party over at the new house a week from tomorrow. If you want to swing by, you'd be more than welcome. As long as the Red Monsoons and Agni Kai don't change my social calendar, I'd love to, said Imanishi. Great. See you then. Hanging up, Cora put her phone away, then flipped to the pro-bending scores, the normal order of things restored once again. Looks like the Spider Wolves got a bit of help from the refs last night. Sinti Liu, Liu Yue 17, 291 ASC. Saturday, June 19th, 2410. Mount Wei Tang, United Republic of Nations, Dicho. The house on Mount Wei Tang was finally ready for move-in, though Anthy, Corwin, and Utna hadn't actually bought anything to go in it yet. Technically speaking, moving wasn't what they would be doing, since they had no existing home of their own in Dicho to relocate furniture from. Tenzin's house had something of the character of a furnished rental in that regard. Furniture or not, though, the completion of the house was worth celebrating. So Corwin had arranged to buy, borrow, or rent the necessary equipment to put on a great late-spring barbecue, and invitations radiated out from Air Temple Island across Dicho and to points beyond the veil. Come to Republic City on Saturday the 19th, they said, and see what we've been up to this spring. When they left Air Temple Island on Saturday morning, the Tenjo Ravenhair complex split up to take on separate tasks. Corwin and Cora saddled up Mogi and headed into Republic City to pick up provisions for the barbecue, meat, fish, and so on, while Nima took the Tenjo part of the party straight up to the site on Vayu, with Annabelle affixed high on Utna's back with Anthy's silken wrap, so that she could get a good view of the flight. They'd all been visiting the construction site at the top of the mountain regularly through the entire process, of course. But Utna couldn't help feeling her heart sore, as Vayu swept into the high valley amidst the peaks of the three brothers, making a long, shallow turn so they could appreciate the view. The house stood dramatically on the shore of Lake Wei Tang, the body of water formed by the waterfall cascading down the central peak's western face. Its main body was a rectangular structure like a Viking or Southern Water Tribe longhouse, arranged with its long axis roughly parallel to the lake shore but with a second story. It rested half on a stone foundation sunk into the lakefront and half on pilings which stood out in the lake itself. The south side and the southern halves of the east and west sides were all walled from roof to footings in great sheets of transparisteel, slightly tinted from without for privacy. From the north end of the two-story section, a single-story wing extended to the west, then dog-legged north again to tuck neatly into a natural corner of the lush mountain meadow that lined the valley up to the shore of the lake. At the north end, this extension bloomed up into a four-story tower, though the top floor was really a large open pavilion for meditation, martial arts practice, or just chilling out on a nice day with a good book. The roof of the single-story section in between was finished as a deck, with entrances to the second story of the main house and the tower. This had been designed with an eye toward entertaining, and for that reason it already had a regular barbecue grill and a small outdoor dining set installed on it as part of the original floor plan, as well as a place for Utrina's telescope and an outdoor pie show table. The rich blue tiles on the roofs of the main building and tower, and the cream-colored timbers of the walls, spoke to Cora's Southern Water Tribe roots, but certain other touches, the contrasting dark wood of doors and window frames, the shapes of the windows and the parts of the house that weren't all window, put Utrina in mind of buildings she'd seen in Asgard. The elements didn't clash, though. Instead, the overall design made for a nice blending of both of its creators' styles, and also incorporated some subtle hints of Air Temple styling. The mildly pagoda-shaped roofs, the pavilion at the top of the tower, as a friendly nod to the benefactors who had made the project possible in the first place. Regarding the finished work, Anthy thought of something Jinora had said to her once and smiled. "A beautiful haven indeed," she remarked to herself. As they grew closer, Annabelle let out a soft sound of interest, and Duchenne turned her head to give the baby a grin. Home looks pretty good, doesn't it, kiddo? Vayu swept down for a landing off to one side a bit, near the jumble of lakeshore rocks that the construction crew had left in place to the south of the house. Nima waited for Uchina and Anthy to disembark, then leaned down and said, "Okay, I'm off to Central Station. We should be just in time to meet the 10:45. See you in a while." "Bye, Nima," said Uchina with a cheery wave, and the air nomad and her bison were off, speeding away toward the city. The Tenjos watched her go, then turned, hand in hand, and headed across toward the gaily striped tents, tables, and chairs that were arrayed on the meadow to the west of the house, making the compound look a bit as if it had been configured for an outdoor wedding. These, and the compact mobile kitchen, adapted from hardware Future Industries made for the United Forces, standing next to the west wing, were Ryo Sato's closing touch. Since the house's kitchen wasn't fully equipped yet, and the mere mortal barbecue grill up on the deck wouldn't be able to handle a party anywhere near the size the householders were expecting, Ryo and his closeout crew, who had stuck around after major completion to finish up the landscaping and put some last touches on the interior, had done a little improvising. Friday afternoon, while one convoy of Future Industries trucks was hauling away the last of the scrap and equipment, another made its way up the winding mountain road, loaded with all the gear that was now arrayed in the meadow, tying the bow on top of a job well done. Ryo was waiting for them now, standing by the kitchen at the head of a small brigade of uniformed Future Industries personnel who would be providing the support for the party. At their approach, he smiled broadly and spread his hands with a wide grin, declaring, "Ladies, Mount Waitang welcomes you." "Thank you, Ryo," said Anthy, smiling. "Where's Minami?" Uchina wondered. "Oh, she'll be along," Ryo assured her. "Staying in the office till the absolute last minute, as usual." "Ha ha ha, of course," said Uchina, laughing. "Why'd I even ask?" "Something not quite right about the girl," Ryo agreed with an insincerely sad nod. A moment later, another sky bison arrived, moving at a rather more leisurely pace. Mugi's saddle was piled with boxes and bags of provisions, all neatly stacked and lashed down, leaving no room for passengers, so Korra was cruising alongside with her airbender glider staff. Corwin set the laden bison down right next to the field kitchen, at which point the staff turned to and started unloading before he could even climb down from Mogi's neck to help. "Rejoice, O partygoers," declared Corwin, "for we bring you meat and veggies," he added, as if that were less important. Korra alighted next to him, collapsed her staff, and slipped it into a pocket on the side of Mogi's saddle, saying, "I'll head back to round up the others. Don't start without me." "I wouldn't dream of it," Corwin replied dryly, drawing a snicker and a punch on the shoulder before she sprang up to Mogi's pilot's seat and took hold of the reins. The kitchen crew had already finished stripping him of his cargo by the time she got into position, so she headed out without delay, turning the bison back toward the city. "Well, you three," said Ryo. "Five," Garnet corrected him automatically. "Five," Ryo amended without comment. "Before things get to really jumping up here, there's something we ought to take care of. Follow me." Ignoring their curious looks for the moment, Ryo led the way to the decorative double door on the west side of the main house, which opened into the fully glazed, double-height south end of the living room. Once they were all up on the stoop, he took a brass key with a head in the shape of the Future Industries logo from his pocket and handed it to Corwin, remarking, "Got to do this thing right, son." Corwin regarded the key for a second, then smiled, unlocked the door, and opened it. The room beyond had been specifically designed to have the most visual impact of any place in the house, with the possible exception of one special room downstairs. The ground floor of the main house was basically one large room, its east face fully glazed, The northern two-thirds or so was single-story, but at the south end it opened up into a great open space with nothing but air from the floor to the roof beams. A balcony overlooked it from the second floor, beyond which were the upstairs bedrooms and whatnot. With transparasteel walls from top to bottom, this section was almost like being outside, a sort of grand-scale expression of the Air Nomad sun parlor concept, with spectacular views of Lake Waitang to the east, and the meadow and distant Republic City to the west. "Oh my," said Anthy. "It's even more amazing than I thought it would be from the drawings." "It's pretty amazing, all right," Uchna agreed, standing in the middle of the two-story room and turning slowly around to take it all in. "My ancestors would say that putting a building here is disrespectful to the beauty of this landscape," Garnet mused in a thoughtful tone, then went on matter-of-factly, "From this, I can only conclude that my ancestors were idiots, because damn, yo." Rio chuckled. "Thank you kindly, Master Dragon." "Mr. Sato," said Corwin, offering his hand, "you and your people have outdone yourselves." "My dear sir," said Rio, shaking it, "it was our absolute pleasure." Guests arrived in a steady stream over the next hour or so, either shuttled up from the train station by Nima and Vayu, carried from Air Temple Island by Korra and Mogi, or making their own ways to the mountaintop. Corwin's parents and aunts appeared from the lake, courtesy of his mother. He brought a few visitors in from the big universe by window, of which the house had no shortage, while Anthy opened the way for several from Sephira. Caitlin came in on a train as well, but from Sakuragaoka rather than Sipang. She caught a ride up from the station in the back seat of Minami Sato's autogyro, the dramatic arrival of which was trumped shortly thereafter by Nal and Lakpa, who showed up in a style befitting the draconian majesty of the mountain. By noon, everyone was present who was coming, which was just about everyone they knew in Dicho, and a great number of people besides. The main exceptions from the first group were Juni and the Fire Ferrets, who were, with regret, in Nightvale on their great Earth Kingdom road trip and, being scheduled to play that afternoon, couldn't get away even with Corwin's unorthodox assistance, and their friends far off in the South Pole, whom they'd be seeing in a few days anyway. "Everyone?" said Uchna once she'd called everyone together. "This isn't a formal occasion, and there aren't going to be any big speeches, I promise," she added, drawing a few laughs. "But before we all get started, I just wanted to get you all looking the same way for a second, and thank you all for coming." "Yes, thank you, everybody," Corwin agreed. "It's great to see you all." Spreading his arms to indicate the house, which stood as a backdrop behind the five of them, he said, "Welcome to our new home." "Welcome," added Anthy, with a beaming smile before anyone could react, "to Bellhaven." And the cheering began. A kingly lunch was served on the meadow. Thereafter, the house, though largely empty, stood open for the guests' inspection. Everyone who passed through it exclaimed at its many wonders, not least of which was its very location. The other star attraction of the occasion was Annabelle, whom many of the Trinity's Sephirian and Midgardian friends had not yet met. She handled the crowd with grace, no more bothered by it than she had been by ocean travel or open-air flight. By early afternoon, sparring matches and semi-spontaneous games of airball had broken out on the meadow, and many fine times were in progress.
"So when are you actually moving in?" Lakpa wondered.
"When we get back from Glacier Spirits," Uchna told her. "That way we won't have to rush." Lakpa nodded. "Makes sense," she said. "Sure you can't come with us?" asked Corwin. "It's good times."
"I know, I wish I could," Lakpa said. "But I've got a ton of work to do. I'm still just starting my business, you know," she added wryly. "I can't really afford to just hang up the gone fishin' sign any time."
"Sounds like business is good, at least,"
Wakaba Shinohara observed.
It's picking up fast, Lakpa confirmed. Turns out there's a pretty good niche there that nobody else was filling.
You look like it's agreeing with you, too, Uchina put in, and Anthy nodded agreement.
The airbender did look like the life of an independent courier was to her liking. She had a color in her cheeks and a brightness in her eyes that she'd lacked when Anthy had first met her, as an unmotivated young air nomad on the doorstep of a vocational crisis. She'd come to the party straight from work and was still dressed in her uniform, a snug-fitting flight suit-like coverall in some black, grid-woven fabric, bedecked with many pockets and reinforcing patches on the high wear areas.
I think it is, Lakpa said. I mean, it's hard work, don't get me wrong, but you meet all sorts of people and get to go all over the city. It's interesting, and it's a lot of fun.
Except when it's raining. Then it's not so much fun, she added wryly.
This glider is amazing, Cora said, looking up from her inspection of Sam.
It's so light.
She grinned and added, I bet you can really move with this thing.
Lakpa grinned. Isn't it great? Ryo and I worked together on it. His idea, sort of a melding of a proven design and the latest materials. The main body and wing frames are all carbon fiber, and the wing membranes are some kind of memory fabric they originally developed for United Forces tents, of all things. It's activated by electricity. The glider works without it, but with the power turned on, the wings get a lot stiffer. It'll really carry an updraft. More maneuverable, too.
She reddened slightly.
Sorry, I don't mean to brag, but it's hard not to get excited about my gear.
Hey, don't apologize. This is awesome, said Cora.
Nudging her with an elbow, she went on,
So what's the fastest you've gone?
Well, it's not like I have an airspeed indicator, Lakpa said wryly. But at a guess, I'd say around 120.
Cora blinked. Get out, she said. As in miles per hour? Damn, girl. Were you testing in a typhoon or something?
Lakpa grinned. I had a pretty stiff tailwind, but mostly I wanted to find out how hard I could push it if I had to. Like I say, I don't know exactly how fast I was going, but I outran the RCR traffic spotter.
I bet that guy's sworn off cactus juice, Corwin quipped.
All right, that's it. I gotta get me one of these, Cora remarked, collapsing the high-tech staff and handing it back to its owner.
Where's Ryo?
Out watching the... Uchina began, then trailed off as she noticed a small object approaching in the sky to the west. That wasn't entirely odd, except that all the airbenders she knew were here already, as was Wakaba. So who? A moment later, she had her answer, as the shape of a man arced down out of the clear blue sky and landed with a resounding thump in the middle of the meadow, not far from the impromptu airball court. Startled, the players broke off their game and turned to look. As the burly figure rose from the crouch he'd fallen into on landing, dusted grass from his knees and looked around. He was a big man, broad-shouldered and brawny-looking in a way that put many of the locals in mind of earthbenders, but with red hair that flamed in the afternoon sun and a great tawny beard done up in heavy plait, not a color or style commonly seen in Dicho. More remarkably still, he was dressed in what appeared to be some kind of odd ceremonial armor, heavy-looking, decoratively carved plates of some lustrous silvery metal affixed to sturdy dark fabric, with a rich scarlet cape falling from his armored shoulders nearly to the ground. And he was holding what appeared to be an iron mallet with a head the size of a paving stone.
"Greetings," he declared in a booming voice, big white teeth flashing in a friendly grin as he hung the hammer by a leather thong on his belt. "Sorry I'm late."
"Thor," said Uchina, delighted, as she emerged from the house to give him a hug, armor and all. "What are you doing here? And why are you all dressed up?" she wondered,
touching one of the carved plates on his cuirass with a puzzled look.
"Well met, Prince Tendro," said Thor, bussing her cheerfully on the forehead. "You are looking radiant as always. And here are Lady Anthe and my great niece at last," he added, opening his arms for Anthe and her daughter. "Ah, she's just as beautiful as my little sister said she would be. Hello, little one. I'm your father's Uncle Thor. Yes, go on and tug Great Uncle Thor's beard. I promise you it's real."
Utrinna wasn't entirely sure her worldview could adapt to the notion of a dotingly avuncular thunder god on such short notice. But fortunately, before she had time to explore it further, he spotted another member of the gathering and straightened up, extracting his plait gently from Annabelle's grasp. Composing himself into an unaccustomed air of formality that was made all the more striking by his elaborate armor, Thor bowed very correctly to Korra as she approached and said,
"Korra Tonrakstotir, Avatar of Dicho, we meet again."
Korra gave him a look almost as puzzled as the one he'd received from Utrinna, even as she automatically made the Water Tribe salute in response to his bow.
"What's up? Why so formal?" she wondered.
"I'm here on official business," Thor explained, a slightly wry smile touching his craggy face. "As a member of the Council of the Aesir. Shall we speak of it more privately?"
Looking somewhere between excited and apprehensive, she was fairly sure she knew now what this was all about, Korra nodded and went inside.
Utrinna, Corwin, and Anthe all followed, the four of them, plus Annabelle and Garnet, ending up in the empty space that would be the dining room part of the ground floor main room once the furnishings were in place. Drawing himself up formally again, Thor faced Korra and told her,
"Korra of Auyuituk, daughter of Tonrak and Senna, it is my happy duty to inform you that your application for permission to visit the Golden City has been approved."
Dipping a hand into one of the pouches at his belt, he removed a small object and held it out to her on an open palm.
"Congratulations."
Korra blinked, her face going momentarily blank with surprise. She'd been hoping to hear about this sometime soon, but she hadn't expected one of the Aesir Council to come and deliver the news in person. Then, hesitantly, she reached out with a slightly trembling hand and took the object from his palm, turning it over in her own hand to regard it. It was a small metal token, like a miniature medal, on a sturdy black cord, and embossed on its face was one of the ancient Proto-Norse runes Corwin's people used in all their most formal and important documents. Yera.
"Wear that when you visit, and you will be welcome anywhere in the Upper Realms," Thor told her. "Alfheim, Vanaheim, Asgard."
He smiled less formally and added,
"Including Valhalla. Come whenever you like. It's valid for 1 year."
Slowly, as if in a dream, Korra ducked her head and passed the token's cord over it, settling it around her neck. Then she picked it up again, closing her hand around it, and stood regarding her fist for a moment in silence, tears welling in her eyes.
"Thank you," she said softly. "I can't... I'm not good with..."
Thor waited for the others to enfold her in a mass embrace, then put his great arms around all of them and replied in a pleasant rumble,
"Don't fret, Valkyr Elskling. Neither am I."
If anyone noticed that the Avatar, though buoyantly cheerful when they all rejoined the party, nevertheless appeared to have been quite recently crying, no one was undiplomatic enough to mention it. His official tasks disposed of, Thor dismissed his ceremonial armor using a charm Urd had taught him, and mingled with the partygoers in his less formidable, but no less visually arresting in this crowd, civilian guise. "Oh, Corwin, before I forget," he said, just before the eddies of the party carried him and his nephew in separate directions.
I left a care package from home for you and Noll in the fridge at the house where you've been staying. A few delicacies you can't get around here, some things from Draconia, and a slice of your aunt's famous apple pie," he added with a grinning wink. "Thanks," said Corwin, but before he could offer any follow-up inquiries, if he'd been planning to, Wakaba appeared and dragged him off to join a game of kickball she was organizing. As afternoon settled toward evening, the party didn't so much break up as erode, becoming a steadily smaller and more intimate gathering as various of the guests parted from the hosts and turned their attention to other matters. Finally, just before dark, the last bison load of guests headed back to town with Nima at the helm, and only the Trinity, their offspring, Cora, and Wakaba remained.
"Well, I'd say that was a success," said Wakaba, grinning. "All that's left now is to clean up this mess," she added, indicating the minor shambles the meadow had become.
"Rio said he and his crew would take care of it in the morning," Corwin said. "Remember to get them all something really nice," Utrinus said, as much to herself as anyone else.
"Totally," Corwin agreed.
2 June 22nd. Nanisevik, Southern Water Tribe. The first day of the Southern Water Tribe's 3-day Glacier Spirits Festival was not the festive part. Rather, it was a time reserved for private reflection, alone or in small familial groups. The communal aspects of the occasion came later, and the real party bit wasn't until day 3. As such, Nanisevik was quiet when Cora, Corwin, the Tenjos, Nima, and the Satos arrived by private jet in the early evening. The capital's normally bustling streets were virtually deserted as they made their way from Chief Hakoda International Airport to their lodgings for the week, a townhouse near Future Industries South's headquarters in the financial district. There, after getting settled, they passed a quiet evening meditating on the nearness of the spirits, or reading about the history and significance of the occasion, or, in the cases of Garnet and Annabelle, mostly sleeping. The festival's second day was also supposed to involve quiet reflection, but in a more public, communal spirit. In the early evening, not that there physically was evening in the South Pole in June, Cora led the others down to the city's central square, where the Southern Water Tribe's chief Angakuk traditionally led the festival's central public observance. Utrina was reminded a little bit of the New Year's Eve gatherings on the Grand Common in Avalon Center Park. There was that same spirit of community and goodwill, extended even toward obvious strangers like herself, but it was a much more ordered and solemn affair. Not grim, but serious and reserved. The Angakuk, an elderly woman in an elaborate set of furred garments, explained the history of the occasion. Most of her audience presumably already knew what she was telling them, but Utrina found it interesting, and Anthe's attention, she noticed with a little smile, was riveted, as lore singer Kyra described the festival's earliest beginnings in a roundly oratorial style. Its decline after the Southern Water Tribe's near extinction of almost 200 years before into a simple celebration, and the restoration of balance that had taken place after a great spiritual crisis 120 years ago.
"That is why we reflect in private on the first day and together on the second," Kyra said. "Because our ancestors forgot that this is a time for considering the spirits, and the spirits..."
She paused, looking theatrically thoughtful, then smiled mischievously and said,
"No, the spirits weren't angry. But things were out of balance, and their feelings were hurt."
A ripple of quiet laughter made its way around the square at that, and the smiling Angakuk went on,
"But the spirits aren't cruel or heartless. They don't demand unhappiness of us, whatever some so-called experts would have had us believe. And so tomorrow we celebrate, as our supposedly decadent ancestors did before us. Only we invite the spirits to join us, like good neighbors should. That, my children, that is balance."
A wave of vociferous agreement passed over the crowd. Adutuna was intrigued to note that Cora was part of it, raising a fist and calling cheerfully, "Hear, hear!" After the congregation quieted again, Kyra led them in a short and simple invocation, pledging the community's friendship and fellowship with the spirits of the southern glaciers. There was a moment of silence, and the gathering broke up, people filtering back to their homes to throw what amounted to 10,000 low-key dinner parties. As his own family left the square to do likewise, Corvin had the sudden, unaccountable feeling that he was being scrutinized. He looked around, puzzled for its source. Some way off to his right, he saw a girl standing under a lamppost near the end of one of the many canal-spanning bridges in this part of the city. He got only the most fleeting glimpse of her, just enough to get an impression rather than an actual image. Pale skin, light-colored hair, a bulky jacket. And then she turned to her left and disappeared into the shifting crowd. "Hey, Decho to Corwin," said Cora, nudging him with an elbow. "You with us?" "Huh?" he replied, blinking. "Sorry, I thought I saw..." He shook his head. "Never mind. Did you ask me something?" "Do you want takoyaki or seaweed noodles for dinner?" asked Uchina. "Yes, please," Corwin replied, grinning, and thought no more about the strange encounter that night. Back at the townhouse, they had a festive dinner, then spent a more convivial evening lounging around the living room and chatting. With the solemn, contemplative part of the festival done with, all were looking forward to the third and final day to come. Not just those who had attended it before, but also those for whom it would be the first. Caitlin arrived a little bit before midnight, tired but happy after a red-eye flight from Sakuragaoka via Republic City. She reported that all was well with her charges at Sato Academy, and that they sent along their goodwill. "Mio, in particular, asked me to say hello to you, Corwin," said Kate with a mischievous little smile. "What is it with you, anyway?" Ryo wondered. "Some guys got it," Minami said before Corwin could reply. "It's not like that," Corwin said, his voice mild. "She's a nice kid. We kind of bonded on the common grounds of the bass guitar and having difficult friends," he added wryly. "Speaking of which, it's a shame Nall couldn't be here," said Garnet. "I guess I'll have to sub for him." Adopting a half-lidded smirk that was completely ridiculous on her tiny dragon face, she went on, "Do tell, Corwin. Did you have some nice jam sessions?" Rolling her fire opal eyes to the side, she glared at Utrina until her snout was released, then said, "Not you, too." "Have a little class. The kid's 16, Utrina chided her. "Yeah, well, so's Nima," Garnet replied. "Don't drag me into this," said Nima, blushing. "This went someplace really weird really suddenly," Cora observed. "It's a dragon thing," Corwin said wearily. "Anyway, thank you, Kate, and please tell her I said hi back when you see her again, and not anything the innuendo serpent over here said." He gave Garnet a grumpy look and added, "Just because Azana's in the North Pole this week, you figure you've got to have another outlet." "Oi!" Garnet objected, trying without much success to draw herself up with dignity, while everyone laughed. Thursday, June 24th. The front hall of the Sato townhouse resembled the staging area of a small military operation, only with a more cheerful sense of anticipation. As everyone who was staying there made final preparations to hit the third, last, and most festive day of the Glacier Spirits Festival. Decked out in all her polar gear, Utrina was making certain of Annabelle and Garnet in Anthea's Amautik when the last of the party to make ready arrived. "All right," Cora declared, bounding down the stairs.
In keeping with festival tradition, she had on her best anorak over her formal, high-collared tunic and fur-caped trousers that looked practically new.
"Are you guys ready to have some fun?"
Everybody turned and just looked at her for a moment, prompting her to inquire,
"What?
Is this the Nanisevic equivalent of the hat?" Uchna wondered, flipping a hand through her own loose, feathery hair. Cora, for the first time Uchna had yet seen, didn't have most of her hair up in her customary high ponytail, or the formal white cloth cap-covered bun she'd sported at Uchna and Corwin's wedding. Her sidelocks were tied as usual, but the rest of her thick brown hair was down, falling about her shoulders and down into the laid-back hood of her anorak. It gave her a surprisingly different look, and one Uchna realized not too unlike her own. Cora's hair wasn't feathery like hers, but had a tendency instead to fall in waves, a little like Kate's. But the unstudied, casual ease of the look was the same.
"Oh, heh, nah," said Corwin, grinning. "I just felt like changing up my game a little for the day."
"Nothing wrong with a little variation."
She nudged Corwin with an elbow.
"Eh, Corwin?"
"We're all going to die," said Nima with heavy mock fatalism.
"Beg pardon, Master Nima?"
Cora inquired, pretending to have missed the remark.
"Nothing," Nima replied with a little smile. "All right, then," said Cora with a fierce grin as she opened the front door. "Let's do this thing."
They did that thing.
On its third day, the Southern Water Tribe's Glacier Spirits Festival ceased to be a time of contemplation or benediction, and became a celebration, half carnival, half fair. The downtown streets were lined with booths and stalls offering all manner of items, from 1,000 kinds of street foods to handicrafts and goods of virtually any description. Bright lamps and signs, decorative torches, and luminous spirits were everywhere, filling the polar night with color and life. And the streets bustled with people, human and spirit alike, the former dressed in their best, and the latter putting on an extra showy display. The skies above, too, were filled with spirits, darting and dancing, giving their all for the sheer pleasure of painting the night sky with their light. The centerpiece of the whole affair was the city's central square, which had been the site of the mass public benediction the afternoon before. Now, cleared of all structures and then covered in an even layer of ice, it served as the arena for a sprawling, cheerfully free-form game of what looked to Uchna like a cross between ice hockey, association football, and a friendly street fight. After a lap of the food and crafts stalls, Uchna and Cora were drawn almost gravitationally to this intriguing attraction. As they approached the sidelines, they were greeted by a young man wearing the armband of a Nanisevic tribal constabulary volunteer medic, whom Cora seemed to know already.
"Hey, there you are," she said, hugging the medic with a cheerful grin.
"I knew I'd find you somewhere out here. Uchna, this is Bori, Karana's little brother. Excuse me, Dr. Bori. I have to remember that now," she added with a wink.
"I'm not one to stand on ceremony," said the young doctor. "Just Bori is fine."
"This is Uchna Tenjo," Cora went on. "You probably heard about the little show she and I put on at Falling Dark this year."
"Mom hasn't talked about much else since," said Bori wryly. Then, offering Uchna a Water Tribe salute, he said, "Pleasure to meet you. Enjoying the festival?"
"You bet," Uchna said. Gesturing to his medical insignia, she asked, "You getting much business?"
"Just bumps and scrapes so far," said Bori with a smile. "Things don't usually get too out of hand, but people are always going to get knocked around a little playing bandy, especially when the bigger spirits decide to join in," he added.
"Bandy, huh?" Uchna said. "Looks kind of like hockey, only bigger."
"Similar," Bori agreed, nodding.
"Some people call it South Pole hockey, though actually both games originated in the big universe. If you know the rules of hockey, though, it's easy enough to make the transition."
Hmm. Is it an organized league, or can anybody play? Utina wondered.
Open to all, said Bori with an expansive gesture. Skates in that kiosk there. Do me a favor and get a mouthguard fitted, too, while you're there. Putting teeth back is a pain.
Utina laughed.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, she said, clouting him on the shoulder. And then she and Cora went to draw some gear and join one of the pickup games. On opposite sides, naturally. When last they had met in battle at a Water Tribe festival, back in April at the Falling Dark Festival in Senna, Utina had come out on top, but now Cora demonstrated that, in bandy, if not in sword fighting, experience and ruthlessness would generally overcome youth and enthusiasm. With the Avatar's mettle redeemed, the two left the field of honorable battle arm in arm and laughing, waving to their cheering new throng of admirers, and hit the Hen and Spuds stand before steering their posse southward. South of the square, the booths began to take on more of the aspect of carnival attractions, with many of them featuring games of skill or chance. My original team and I hit this festival one time in the 190s, when your great-grandma Hikari was 11, I think, Cora said to Minami and Ryo as the group of them headed down Canal Street. Man, we did a number on the gaming booths that year. Between the four of us, we won Hikari so many stuffed animals her mom had to ship them back north in a freight container. She grinned a little goofily at the memory. I think we still have those, Ryo said. Grand Mirai told me once that was where that giant tiger seal came from. Minami laughed. That was my favorite when we were little, she recalled. I used to sleep with it. What do you mean, used to? Ryo asked. Hey! Step up! Step up! Cried the barker at the nearest gaming booth as they approached it. Put the coin on the peg and win! Three throws for a yuan. Who will give it a shot? You, sir! He said, leveling his pointing stick at Corbin. What do you say? Try your skill and win a nice prize for your lady friend, he added, traversing the stick to indicate Utina beside him. Or your other lady friend, he went on, taking note of Anthy next to her, then looked to Corwin's left and registered the local girl standing there. Or your third lady friend? Scratching his head sheepishly, the barker leaned forward and said in a stage mutter, Jeez, kid, you're making the rest of us look bad over here. Some guys got it. All the women in the group, and Garnet, who performed an ostentatious up-periscope from Anthy's Amout to join in, chorused before Corwin could say anything in reply, causing both him and the barker to break up laughing. Thank you, Corwin remarked dryly as he recovered his breath. Then, after surveying the prizes on offer for a moment, he pointed to the largest of them. A stuffed polar bear dog that, while nowhere near life-size, would have made a fairly respectable child's bed. How many do I have to hit in a row to win that? He asked. The barker raised an eyebrow, giving him a toothy grin. 10 throws, my good man, he said, then lifted an admonishing finger and declared, But I warn you, no one has ever done it. Not true, said Cora cheerfully. I once saw it done, 100 years ago. The barker blinked, then blinked again, as he belatedly realized that the local girl to his mark's left was in fact Avatar Cora. Oh, Avatar, I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. Friends of yours? He added, realizing as he did so what an idiotic question it was. Better believe it, Cora replied breezily. What do you think, Corwin? She asked. Are you up for it? Hey, don't be doing my job for me, the barker protested with a smile. Corwin grinned, dug around in the front pocket of his parka for a moment, then banged a 5 yuan bill down on the counter. Give me 15, he said. It might take me a couple to get my eye in. I do like a man who thinks big, said the barker, making the bill disappear and replacing it with a neatly arced array of tokens in a single smooth maneuver, which everyone had to take a moment and admire.
The tokens were stylized, slightly enlarged replicas of Earth Kingdom old Yuan coins, round with a square hole in the middle. 10 feet or so in front of where Corwin stood, a square peg a little bit smaller than the hole stood on a decorated platform, its base hidden beneath a little mound of similar tokens. Corwin picked up one of the coins and weighed it thoughtfully in his hand, running his thumbnail along the knurled edge. It was bigger than a real old yuan, but slightly lighter. Made of purified aluminum, he guessed, to make it harder for metalbenders to cheat without the insane cost and high theft risk of platinum or gold. Well, that didn't matter. He had no intention of cheating. After a moment's pause to center himself, he positioned the first of his tokens atop his left fist and flipped it up and out with his thumb. He missed with the first attempt, and with the second as well, drawing good-natured japes from the barker. That was part of his job, after all. But he paid the man no mind. Those weren't misses in the conventional sense, anyway. They were ranging shots. He had the weight now, and if the game were legit and all the tokens really the same, there would be no need for another. He picked up the third token, turned it over in his hand, positioned it, and let fly. It fell neatly over the peg and rattled to the bottom, settling on the pile of misses with a dull clink. Yup, aluminum. That's one, said the barker unnecessarily. Without comment, Corwin picked up his next token, weighed it, and tossed it. Tunk, rattle, clink. Finding the groove, he settled into a rhythm, and 4 hits later he realized that there was a final twist in the game. It wasn't rigged as such, but the way the peg was constructed, it would get harder as his score mounted, simply because there was less clear peg to hit. Based on the thickness of the tokens and the height of the peg, there would be just barely room on it for all 10 of the required hits, and the accumulation of misses at the bottom would eat up what little reserve there was. It occurred to him belatedly that he should have asked for the target area to be cleared before he started. Oh well, your own fault, he told himself, then applied himself to the task with even greater concentration. The sounds of the festival, the cheering of his friends, and the increasingly snarky remarks of the barker as he piled token on token, all faded away. Tunk, increasingly short rattle, clink. He had 9 on the peg and the 10th in his hand, when the outside world suddenly returned to his consciousness with a snap, like waking from a near nap at the sound of a slamming door. Corwin looked up, his fugue breaking, and tried to place consciously what had changed to call him back. Running feet, people shouting, the unmistakable sound of incipient panic. But it wasn't the sound itself that had pulled him out of the game trance, it was the way both Uchna and Korra had reacted to it, tensing to alert mode on either side of him. Turning, he followed their eyelines back toward the central square, and here came the crowd, dismay on their faces, fleeing from something. Over the tops of the stalls on the other side of the street, a red-orange fireball blooming into the sky, scattering aerial spirits in consternation. Ah, hell, he said, and dropped the 10th token to the counter as he turned with the others to head, as ever, toward the danger. As Corwin, Korra, and Uchna forced their way upstream towards the central square, more bursts of flame lit up the evening sky, followed by a massive, sustained stream that set the upper floors of several buildings ablaze. When they finally reached the edge of the square, the Satos and Anthe had rejoined them. The crowd was thinning here, thanks to a group of Nanisevic tribal constabulary officers who were working to direct people to safety, while several benders threw up barriers of ice to help form a cordon. As they approached, Uchna saw that Bori was among them. Striding up to one with a set of white slashes against the dark blue on his shoulders, Korra got his attention with a brief, sharp whistle. "Sarge, what's the situation in there?" The cop looked briefly surprised to see her, then nodded, getting back to business. "Avatar Korra. It looks like 10, maybe 15 guys causing trouble in there, but they're throwing around more firepower than a fire army battalion. We're trying to get people out until more waterbenders and some SWAT support arrives."
I don't think we have time for that, Utrina objected, as a building's facade began to collapse towards the street. If we don't get someone in there to help fight the fires those guys have started, things are going to get really out of control. Cora nodded, her face drawn with concern. You're right. I saw how much damage just one guy hopped up on Comet could do. I don't know what they're doing down here, but I won't let them do any more damage. Looking over her shoulder, her unspoken question was greeted with nods all around, with Minami punctuating hers by flexing her fingers to create a crackle of sparks as her lightning glove powered up. Between the gesture, her somewhat disarrayed hair, and the little Sato smirk on her face, Cora couldn't help but feel a brief pang of nostalgia. Just like old times. She turned back to the constable, her mouth turned to a slightly edged smile. Consider us your backup. Can you send a few benders in with me and keep the rest of your men on crowd control? You bet, Avatar, said the sergeant. I'm with you, Cora, said Bori as he slung a full water skin over his shoulder. Cora nodded, then started moving toward the barricades at a run. All right, let's go. What had been a friendly, welcoming space at the heart of the city was now a chaotic wreck. Utina noticed the stand where she'd gotten hot chocolate was overturned, the half facing upwards covered in scorch marks. Angry black streaks crossed the paving stones, and most of the tents and pavilions were collapsed into piles of burning fabric. A few unlucky bystanders were still trying to get to safety, but some, mostly waterbenders, had stood fast, trying to contain the fires that were already starting to spread. The men apparently responsible for those fires stood in a knot at the center of the square, a few still occasionally shooting off massive blasts of flame, while others had begun to loot the storefronts and cash boxes. Ha ha! The apparent leader crowed, dressed in a shockingly red three-piece suit that turned to shades of bright orange in the firelight. That's right, boys. Time to show everyone who's in charge now. His eyes blazing, he made a shuffling step forward and unleashed a curtain of flame at what had been the bandy field, splintering the nearest section of the low enclosure wall and setting the neighboring portions ablaze. We don't need to wait another 10 years. We've got all the Comet we need right here. Cora gave a snort as she slid behind the remnants of what had been bleachers for spectators. Oh, I don't think so, pal. As she dropped into a crouch next to the Avatar, Utrina asked, You know this guy? Not exactly, Cora admitted, but it seems pretty clear he's another goon from the Agni Kai. She sighed. I really hate those guys. Any idea what they're doing here? Cora shook her head. Nope. They might have just decided to try making a statement by wrecking the festival, but by the time they got all hopped up on Comet, they probably lost the plot. All most Comet fiends care about when they're on a trip is getting to show off their power. Utrina snorted. Typical. Okay, it's your show. How do you want us to do this? I'll go for Mr. Worst Dressed. Keep some of the others busy and don't get fried. Anthea'd kill me. Cora made brief eye contact with the purple-haired witch and winked. Minami, you and Ryo take down some of the looters. The boys and girls from the NTC ought to be able to help fight those fires once we start getting these jerks to focus on us instead of the buildings. Bori? Oh, sorry, everybody. This is Bori. You're on medical support. Everybody good? With the plan communicated to her friends, Cora took a deep breath, focused herself, and leapt up from her crouch while bringing her arms out and then down. The powerful stroke generated a burst of air beneath her, sending her up like a vertically launched missile. With a shout of, "Hey, buddy!" as she reached apogee, Cora angled herself toward the nattily dressed gangster, who had automatically looked up and locked in on her, punching a wide swath of flame into the air in response. The Avatar swept her arms up as she dropped,
pulling the flames out of the air and wrapping them around her lower body for a flaming drop kick that connected right above the gangster's watch pocket, flinging him backwards. As she rose up from the follow-through, taking up a fighting stance, the rest of her backup swept in, and the melee was on. Corwin had started to join in with the fun, but quickly realized his talents would better serve by bringing up some fire breaks from the paving stones and making sure that none of the more damaged buildings would collapse in on his family and friends. Moving around the edges of the fight, his concentration was almost entirely focused on assessing damage and performing some engineering triage until he spotted something that took him totally by surprise. The girl who had given him that strange vibe the day before was back, but instead of appearing and then disappearing from a crowd, this time she was standing atop one of the few lampposts that were still standing, her feet balanced atop the wrought iron crossbar that supported its light fixtures. His initial brief impression had been correct. Long, oddly pale blue hair, fair skin, and wearing a bulky dark blue coat. She stared down at him with a strangely flat, neutral expression, and he blinked back up at her as they made eye contact. Her eyes were an unusual shade of green that made him think of deep seawater, but slightly glassy. There didn't seem to be any real spark behind them. A doll's eyes. What the? Before he could wrap his brain around anything beyond his initial surprise, the crisis at hand demanded his attention again, as an office building off to his right began to sag toward the street. The fire that was consuming the building had done too much damage for it to be saved, but Corwin was able to use his knowledge of structural engineering and some thick columns of rammed earth and stone to brace it up until the fires could be extinguished, and the building properly demolished. Turning back toward where the strange girl had been standing, he saw nothing but the lamppost, with no sign that anyone had been using it for a perch. Rubbing a hand over his face, Corwin gave a sigh, then shook his head. Today is getting really weird. Fortunately, for the greater part of downtown Nanisevik, the gangsters who had attacked the festival hadn't taken nearly as much Comet as the unlamented Kaiten, but they still did a fair bit of damage before Korra and her impromptu edition of Team Avatar were able to bring all of them down. By the time the fires were completely doused, reports made, and paperwork started, it was well into the evening. Ushna and Anthy had eventually found themselves back at the Sato townhouse, where Ryo let them in with a tired wave. Not long after, Ushna and Ryo disappeared into the kitchen, eventually collaborating on some simple maki rolls and sandwiches to give everyone as they returned, while Anthy settled into one of the well-padded armchairs in the front room, with Annabelle drowsing against her chest, apparently none the worse for the day's excitement. A few minutes after that, Caitlin, Corwin, Nima, and Minami returned. Slightly to Anthy's surprise, Corwin was carrying the enormous stuffed polar bear dog he'd set his sights on at the coin toss booth. "Here," he said with a tired grin, presenting the giant toy to the mother of his child. "Don't say I never gave you nothing." "Oh my," said Anthy. "It's even bigger than it looked in the booth. How did you end up with it?" "We were passing by on our way to sign some paperwork for the cops when the guy who ran the booth spotted us," Minami explained. "Hey, you never took your last throw." "I think he just wanted an excuse to give you something for helping to keep the Agni Kai from burning down his stall," Nima speculated with a little smile. "If that's the case, he'd have felt like kind of a jerk if I was too keyed up from the fracas to throw straight," Corwin observed wryly. "Not much chance of that," said Kate, mussing her brother's hair. "Way too cool." "Yeah, that's me, the Iceman," Corwin replied with a fond eye roll. They all settled into a pensive silence at that point, punctuated with thanks and much consumption once the food arrived. Unsurprisingly, it was Utrina who finally spoke up. "So, what the hell was that all about?"
Nima shook her head. I'm afraid nobody is really sure. Cora and the chief constable were trying to get a hold of Inspector Imanishi up in Republic City when I left. This isn't like anything the Agni Kai have done before.
Minami picked up the thread. I mean, they've always been chauvinistic scumbags clinging to a ridiculously idealized nationalist dogma, but they were still, well, crooks.
Ryo nodded. Protection rackets, gambling, thieving, sure. But not exactly a terrorist group. And Nanisevic is way outside of their usual stamping grounds. While they digested that, and the light meal, the door opened and Cora returned, still in the slightly singed finery she'd been wearing for the festival.
Oh good, she said without preamble. You're all back.
Rubbing a hand over her face for a second, she found a chair and accepted a plate of food before she went on.
It took us a while to get a hold of Itaro, and what I found out when we did wasn't good.
Caitlin's face took on an I-have-a-bad-feeling-about-this look.
The Agni Kai are causing trouble in Republic City, too?
Cora finished chewing a bite of one of her maki rolls, set it back on the plate, and explained. It looks like they had enough comet stockpile to get almost every bender in the triad hopped up, and the ones who didn't come down to Nanisevic, still don't know what that's about, by the way, decided to go on a rampage in Republic City tonight. Pretty much every cop in town who wasn't on sick leave is on the streets tonight trying to keep things under control. There's even talk of the president possibly sending troops over from Red Sand Island to enforce martial law.
Oh, that'll end well, Garnet observed, raising her head from Annabelle's wrap.
Lots of armed people on edge in a city filled with firebending wackos is always a great plan.
Cora snorted.
Yeah, I know. But that's not even the worst bit. Corwin raised an eyebrow.
This gets worse?
Yep. Part of why Itaro was so hard to track down was that he was meeting with one of his CIs inside of the Red Monsoon who had asked him for an emergency meet. Apparently the Monsoons are bringing in the biggest shipment of product yet, and are planning a big meeting at their HQ to turn it over to the Agni Kai.
Corwin frowned and said dryly, That's not a trap or anything.
Cora gave him a tired, slightly crooked smile.
Yeah, totally. But we can't let this get any more out of control than it already is.
Utena nodded.
Okay, so when do we leave?
Leaning back into her chair, Cora sighed, setting the now empty plate onto her lap.
That's complicated.
Anthy raised an eyebrow.
Complicated?
I need to get back to Republic City, but one of the things I'm worried about is that this attack might have been the Agni Kai's way of trying to come after me and the people I care about.
Ice-blue eyes flashed as the Avatar looked around the room.
If you guys go back to Republic City with me, you'll immediately become targets.
Staying here doesn't guarantee we'll be safe, Utena noted. At least up there we've got a chance to fight back.
Maybe. But at the same time, it still puts you right in the line of fire, including Annabelle.
Cora shook her head.
I can't risk that. But there's an alternative. Honestly, one I don't like very much, but at least I can guarantee it'll be safe for you.